up towards the town of Colenso. Unlike Hart, Hildyard had his troops advance in open skirmish order, which did not make them as easy a target. Nevertheless, they too came under fire from boars in their hidden rifle pits. Hildyard's men pressed forward to the edge of the town and took cover, returning the boar fire. Here, they had a little success, driving some of the boars out of their positions, but with the overall attack completely stalled, they could not cross the river. And eventually, they retreated as well. Finally, there was the diversionary assault on Llangwane Hill by Dundonald. He was the most imaginative of all the British commanders, and he pushed his men in skirmish order up through the broken ground at the base of the hill, while also sending some of them around the side to outflank the Boers. Although he had only a small force, he used all of them, and he was pressing the Boers hard. But he did not quite have enough men to break the impasse and capture the hill. He sent urgent messages asking for some of the reserves to be committed. Despite the fact that there were 8 full battalions that had seen no action as of yet, all his requests went unanswered, and so the chance to seize the important high ground was lost. Part of the problem was that Buller, who should have stayed at his central command post to oversee the battle and take advantage of just such opportunities, had instead left it. And he had become obsessed with a relatively insignificant aspect of the battle. This was that battery of 12 cannons that Long had abandoned out on the plain. Seeing them just sitting out there, Buller had become fixated on the idea that the guns had to be recovered in order to prevent the Boers from capturing them. Buller had personally gone to the gully in which the surviving artillerymen were hiding in order to supervise the recovery attempts. And this effectively removed the commander-in-chief from playing any role in the larger battle. A daring group of British troops had managed to run out to the guns, hook up 2 of them to horses, and haul them away. But 10 cannons still remained on the field. Buller called for volunteers to try to save the others, and several young officers put themselves forward for this suicidal duty. Among them was Lieutenant Roberts, who was the only son of one of England's greatest military heroes of the era, Lord Frederick Roberts. While brave, the young Roberts had almost no chance, and he was fatally shot before he had gotten 100 feet. One additional effort failed even to reach the guns, with 7 out of 13 men being shot down, along with 13 out of 22 horses. Buller himself was wounded by a shell fragment that struck him in the side, inflicting a severe bruise. Even though the battle had only been going on for a couple of hours, and even though he still had a good number of his total forces uncommitted, Buller seems to have become completely disheartened and to have lost the ability to objectively evaluate the situation. Buller abruptly called off the attack, and he precipitously ordered everyone to retreat. He was so discouraged that he forbade any additional attempts to recover the cannons, even though likely they could have been safely retrieved once darkness had fallen. The jubilant Boers were able to take possession of 10 fine artillery pieces, and this amounted to almost 1/3 of all the guns in the British Army facing them. In a history written soon after the war, the British performance at Colenso was characterized as bad in its conception, worse in its execution, worst of all in its abandonment. Total British casualties were 1,127 killed, wounded, missing, or captured. On the Boer side, there were fewer than 50 casualties. Due to poor scouting, outdated tactics, and errors of judgment made by the British commanders, it had been a thorough debacle. Barely a month later, the British would suffer another embarrassing and costly disaster at the Battle of Spion Kop. Redvers Buller's reputation was now so low that his critics derisively punned on his name, calling him Reverse Buller. The three defeats of Stormberg, Magersfontein, and Colenso, all of which occurred in the space of just 6 days, were a huge shock for the British. And this period was forever after referred to in England as Black Week. To his credit, although perhaps somewhat belatedly, Buller now began to learn from his mistakes. He launched another offensive, this time carefully gathering intelligence on the route and the Boer positions. His men, this time around, advanced in open order. They made use of all the available cover and natural features of the geography. Carefully aimed artillery softened up the Boer defenses ahead of the troops. And an innovative creeping barrage of cannon fire was employed to give them cover while actually advancing. By these means, the British finally crossed the Thukela River and continued towards Ladysmith. Meanwhile, on the western front of the war, Lord Roberts, whose son had been killed at Colenso, was appointed as commander. He managed to drive back the Boers there and eventually captured Pretoria, and that ended the main phase of the war. Boer guerrillas fought on for some time and harassed the British with hit-and-run raids. To cut off support for them, Roberts controversially rounded up Boer families and imprisoned them in what were called concentration camps. That was the first use of this phrase. He also systematically burned and destroyed farms. A peace treaty was signed in 1902, and shortly thereafter, the Union of South Africa became part of the British Commonwealth with Botha as its first prime minister. The Boer War plainly demonstrated that one era of military tactics was over, and the conflict foreshadowed many of the techniques that would feature in 20th century warfare. The obsolescence of these old methods was most clearly evident at the Battle of Colenso, where the boneheaded determination of the British commanders to utilize outdated tactics resulted in an attack that was completely ineffectual and turned what should have been a battle into little more than target practice for the Boers. An interesting footnote to this battle is that the British employed a corps of stretcher bearers to transport the wounded, and many of these stretcher bearers were drawn from the inhabitants of Britain's colonies. Among those living in South Africa at the time who volunteered for this wartime duty was a 30-year-old native of India, a man who would later become famous for his pacifism, Mohandas Gandhi.
Lecture 19. Tannenberg, Ineptitude in the East.
In the early morning hours of August 30th, 1914, a Russian general named Alexander Samsonov stumbled wearily through a thick morass of mud, water, and weeds in a swamp near the border of East Prussia. As he blundered about in the dark, he was racked by feelings of depression and guilt. Just 4 days earlier, He had been the commander of a mighty Russian army numbering nearly 250,000 men, and he had been leading them on a successful invasion thrusting into German territory. At that time, Samsonov believed that he was right on the verge of trapping the retreating German defenders between his army and another Russian force and completely obliterating them, thus winning a glorious victory. But then everything had gone wrong. The Germans had somehow turned the tables and had shockingly encircled his own army. Attacks from every direction had then fragmented and torn apart his once seemingly invincible battalions. His men had become lost in a nightmarish, maze-like landscape of forest and bogs. Now he and the few remaining members of his staff were on the run, being hounded through the dark woods and swamps by pursuing Germans. Samsonov was 54 years old, overweight, suffered from severe asthma, and was struggling to find the energy to keep dragging his exhausted body across this rugged terrain. Even worse, he was overwhelmed by the knowledge that he had failed his men, his country, and his ruler. His aides overheard him repeatedly castigating himself with the words, "The Tsar trusted me." Around 1 a.m, the small, bedraggled band of refugees paused for a brief rest. Samsonov walked into some nearby woods, took out his pistol, placed it against his temple, and pulled the trigger. This was a rare modern case of a commander-in-chief committing suicide on the battlefield, and it brought to a close one of the most dramatic episodes of the First World War, the Battle of Tannenberg. The years leading up to the outbreak of World War I had seen the European nations locking themselves into a complex web of alliances and treaties. One major power bloc consisted of Germany, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and Italy, while opposing them was a coalition of France, Russia, and the United Kingdom. When contemplating war, Germany's greatest challenge was the fact that it was sandwiched between two powerful potential enemies, Russia to the east and France to the west. Realizing that fighting a war on two fronts was likely to end in defeat, German military planners developed a bold strategy known as the Schlieffen Plan, which called for launching a swift attack on France that would drive towards Paris, capture it, and thus, hopefully, knock France out of the war in just 6 weeks. The catch was that to make the thrust to Paris strong enough to succeed on such an abbreviated timetable, they would have to devote nearly the entirety of the German armed forces to that effort. And this meant leaving the eastern border with Russia practically unguarded. But the Germans calculated that the vast but ponderous main Russian army would require at least 8 to 10 weeks to mobilize. And thus, if they could finish off France within that specified 6 weeks, they would just have enough time to then hop on trains and redeploy their armies back across Germany to take on Russia in the east. Accordingly, the plan called for committing 7 of the 8 German field armies to the attack on France, leaving just one, appropriately enough labeled the 8th Army, to guard the eastern border with Russia. While the main Russian armed forces would take several months to mobilize, they did already have 2 large armies stationed on the border. These were the 1st and 2nd Russian armies. And it was these that the German 8th Army would have to hold off while their Western comrades were conquering France. The German 8th Army numbered about 150,000 men, while the two Russian armies facing it could muster close to 400,000 men. So the Germans would be heavily outnumbered. Because of this, they expected those two Russian armies to immediately advance into Germany upon the outbreak of war. In fact, Russia's treaty with France specified that if Germany attacked France, the Russians were obligated to themselves launch an invasion of Germany within 15 days. On August 3rd, 1914, Germany declared war on France. And the next day, the Western German armies began their drive towards Paris. With that act, all of these complex treaties were activated. The war plans were put into action, and the armies were mobilized. The Russians were true to their word. And on August 17th, just barely within the 15-day limit, troops of the Russian First Army crossed the border and began their promised attack. The German territory that they were invading was called East Prussia. This was a region located along the Baltic Sea, and today it's split between Poland and the Kaliningrad district of Russia. One thing in the Germans' favor was the difficult terrain that the Russians would have to traverse. This section of East Prussia was very sparsely inhabited, and the terrain was made up of a mix of swamps, hills, little lakes, forests, and kind of scrubby, sandy fields. It was a confusing topography, with few major roads and seemingly endless chains of tiny lakes linked by nearly impassable bogs and fens. Right in the middle of this zone were the Masurian Lakes, a 50-mile-long network of waterways and bodies of water that constituted a formidable barrier. The Masurian Lakes created a natural split in the invading Russian forces, with one army having to swing north of them and the other south. With this rugged terrain and with few landmarks, the region where the coming conflict would play out favored defense and impeded any attempt at rapid movement. The man in charge of the German 8th Army, who had been given the difficult task of holding off the horde of Russian invaders, was General Maximilian von Prittwitz. By the outbreak of World War I, he had been a soldier for nearly 50 years, and he had a reputation as a harsh disciplinarian and a solid, if maybe not inspired, commander. His Russian opponents were Pavel von Rennenkampf, who led the Russian First Army, and Alexander Samsonov, the general of the Russian Second Army. The Russian High Command directed Rennenkampf and the First Army to advance into East Prussia, passing to the north of the Masurian Lakes, while Samsonov and the Second Army went around the southern end. This pincer movement was intended to catch the German 8th Army between the two Russian forces and annihilate it. Rennenkampf and Samsonov were instructed to proceed with calm minds and trusting in God, and that at all times, the closest liaison must be maintained between the First and Second Armies. The two Russian generals had surprisingly similar careers. They each had seen extensive service along Russia's eastern borders. Both had been in charge of cavalry units during the Boxer Rebellion, and both of them had then gone on to command Cossack divisions during the Russo-Japanese War. While each had earned a reputation for bravery, both had also been criticized for being lax about conducting proper reconnaissance. But despite their parallel careers, They were from very different social classes. Renninkampf was a haughty aristocrat who had connections to the Russian court, while Samsonov was of humbler origins. It's often claimed that the two men were arch enemies who intensely hated one another. There's even an often repeated story that one time when they encountered one another randomly on a railway platform, that they had gotten into an undignified fist fight. However, recent scholarship has proven that this colorful tale is just not true. At the time the incident supposedly occurred, Renninkampf was actually in a hospital. While their feud seems to have been exaggerated, they were indeed members of rival cliques within the Russian officer corps. And it is likely that there was some animosity between them. In the coming campaign, such a relationship would not have helped them to maintain the close liaison specified in their orders. The Russian invasion of East Prussia began promisingly, with Renninkampf's northern army crossing the border, brushing aside the German defenders in its path. By August 20th, they had advanced over 20 miles, and the German commander, Prittwitz, decided to attempt a counterattack near a town named Gumbinnen. After some back-and-forth fighting, the Russian heavy artillery helped to blunt the attack, and it was the Germans who ended up falling back in confusion. Rather than aggressively pressing his advantage, as he really should have, however, Renninkampf seems to have been content with this relatively minor victory, and his pursuit of the Germans would be lackadaisical in the extreme. Meanwhile, at roughly the same time that Prittwitz heard about the reversal at Gumbinnen, a report reached him that the southern Russian Second Army under Samsonov also seemed to be advancing into East Prussia. At hearing this, Prittwitz appears to have lost his nerve and to have become convinced that his forces were routed and that he was in imminent danger of being encircled by the Russians. Now, in reality, the situation was nowhere near this dire. But Prittwitz precipitously decided to abandon the entire region and to withdraw his army 200 miles all the way back behind the Vistula River. In a panicky phone call to the German high command, he announced his plans to retreat. Once he calmed down a bit, Prittwitz began to have second thoughts about his hasty decision. But by then, the German high command had lost faith in him, and he was fired. As a replacement, they called upon a retired war hero, Paul von Hindenburg. He was one of Germany's most eminent generals. Big and bluff, Hindenburg always maintained a calm, impassive demeanor, and he could be counted on not to get flustered, as Prittwitz apparently had. Upon being offered the assignment, the stoic Hindenburg replied with the simple phrase, "I am ready." Hindenburg's chief of staff was another good choice, Erich Ludendorff, an energetic and creative officer. This pairing of Hindenburg and Ludendorff would prove to be an inspired one, with the men cooperating smoothly and exhibiting complementary qualities. Hindenburg himself once commented, "I have often described my relations with Ludendorff as a happy marriage," while Ludendorff stated that they worked together like one man in the most perfect harmony. This dynamic duo boarded a specially chartered express train, and they rushed through the night towards the front in order to assume command and attempt to salvage the situation. Back in East Prussia, not all of Prittwitz's staff shared his pessimism. One of these officers was a man named Max Hoffmann. And in the Russian advance, he saw a potential opportunity. Already separated by the Missourian Lakes, the Russian 1st and 2nd armies did not seem to be coordinating their movements. While Samsonov in the south was now proceeding steadily into East Prussia, the complacent Rennenkampf in the north meandered along, barely moving. Currently, the different units of the German 8th Army were widely dispersed as they tried to oppose both Russian armies. And remember, they were outnumbered by a factor of nearly 3-1 by the two Russian armies. If, however, the Germans concentrated all of their units together, then they might just be able to take on one of the Russian armies on terms that were close to equal. Hoffmann, therefore, proposed withdrawing all the units that were currently facing Rennenkampf in the north and concentrating them against Samsonov's army in the south. This was an extremely risky move, because if Rennenkampf were to advance more aggressively, there would be absolutely nothing to stop him. Another danger was that even if the Germans massed against Samsonov, Rennenkampf might suddenly turn south and march to assist him, trapping the Germans between the two Russian armies. Everything depended on Rennenkampf maintaining his glacial pace and upon the two Russian armies failing to coordinate their movements. When Hindenburg and Ludendorff arrived and assessed the situation, they quickly came to the same conclusion as Hoffmann, and the bold plan was put into action. Between August 21st and 26th, the German units facing Rennenkampf disengaged and marched swiftly southward to join up with their comrades opposing Samsonov. In this redeployment, the Germans made excellent use of the available rail networks to quickly shift large quantities of troops. Only a handful of cavalry was left behind as a flimsy screen to maintain contact with Rennenkampf and to try and convince him that the German units were still positioned in front of him. During this tense time, the Germans' resolve to persist in their maneuver was bolstered by several terrible blunders made by the Russians. First of all, early in the invasion, a copy of the Russians' plans had been found on the body of a dead officer. This document gave the Germans advanced knowledge of the routes that the two armies would take, and it confirmed that they would proceed by separate paths divided by the Missourian Lakes. Second, the Russian army's communication equipment was woefully inadequate. For the entire 250,000 men of the Second Army, there were only 25 telephones and just 2 portable radios. And so this ensured that there really could not be close cooperation among different units. Third, true to their natures, neither Rennenkampf nor Samsonov devoted sufficient effort to reconnaissance in order to try and track the Germans' movements. And finally, between the two Russian armies, there was a near total lack of communication. Even worse, when messages were sent by radio between the Russian generals, incredibly, they were not coded, but they were just sent out in the clear. The Germans were therefore able to listen in on these transmissions, and so they could keep apprised of the Russian plans and movements. There's really almost no advantage in war greater than knowing your enemy's plans, and in this instance, not only did the Germans know the Russians' intentions, but they were also getting regular real-time updates on the status and positions of the Russian units. By August 27th, the Germans had redeployed, and they were assaulting Samsonov from all sides. The bewildered Russian battalions were caught by surprise, and strung out. But still, they fought back with dogged determination. For the next 3 days, the German vice continued to close around the beleaguered Russians, forcing them into a smaller and smaller pocket. There was a nearly continuous series of desperate little battles fought in the bogs and forests of East Prussia. Some of this fighting even took place at night, as battalions ran into one another in the labyrinthine landscape. Another factor that now came into play was the inadequate supply system of the Russian army. There were not enough transport animals to carry the necessary supplies, and in general, the measures taken to keep the men fed were badly organized and insufficient. The Russians had been on the move for over a week, and as Samsonov's men struggled through the rough terrain, they were now in a weakened state from lack of food. For example, the long-suffering men of one army corps had to make 9 forced marches in a row without receiving anything at all to eat. All this time, Hindenburg and Ludendorff were anxiously watching Rennenkampf's army to the north. If Rennenkampf were to turn south and come to the aid of Samsonov, he could easily push aside that thin screening force and come crashing in on the Germans from the rear. This was the crisis point of the battle. The Germans were steadily chipping away at Samsonov's encircled army, but they needed enough time to finish its destruction. During this process, the Germans were completely vulnerable to a sudden thrust from Rennenkampf. Of this situation, Ludendorff stated, "Rennenkampf's formidable host hung like a thundercloud to the northeast. He only needed to close with us, and we would have been beaten." But Rennenkampf did not come to Samsonov's rescue. Instead, he just continued his crawling progress due westward. Whether his failure to turn south was the consequence of animosity towards Samsonov, a failure to properly scout out what the Germans were doing, faulty communication, or blind obedience to his initial orders is uncertain. Maybe it's a combination of all these factors. Whatever the cause, the result was that the Germans were able to complete their destruction of the Russian Second Army. By August 30th, Samsonov's vast army had been utterly shattered, and Russian resistance had crumbled. That night, Samsonov, physically worn out, psychologically guilt-ridden, committed suicide by shooting himself in the head. Now, for the Germans, it was a matter of simply inflicting as many casualties and capturing as many prisoners as possible. And that was the focus of the next day, August 31st, to which the Germans gave the evocative name, the Day of the Harvesting. Incredible numbers of exhausted and demoralized Russian troops began to surrender to the Germans. The Russian losses amounted to 92,000 men taken prisoner and 50,000 dead and wounded, for a total of 140,000 casualties. Against that shocking number, German casualties were a mere 10 to 15,000. The elated German commanders had to select a name for their victory when reporting it. And Ludendorff decided to call it the Battle of Tannenberg. The small village of Tannenberg was indeed nearby. But the real reason that this name was chosen was for symbolic purposes. And this was because 500 years earlier, the Germanic Teutonic Knights had been beaten by a Polish-Lithuanian coalition at the Battle of Tannenberg in 1410. That event had marked the end of medieval German expansion to the east, and it was remembered in Germany as one of the most catastrophic defeats in all of their history. Therefore, by giving the victorious 1914 battle the same name, Ludendorff was symbolically avenging and wiping clean the disgrace of the earlier debacle. The rest of the staff enthusiastically endorsed this bit of pro-Germanic propaganda. Rennenkampf was still deep in German territory, with an army as large as, or even larger than, the German Eighth Army. And so Hindenburg and Ludendorff now turned to this threat. They once again redeployed their forces, moving them northward to face Rennenkampf. On September 8th, they began attacking the northern Russian army. This conflict would last 5 days, and would be labeled the Battle of the Masurian Lakes. Over this time, Rennenkampf's army was pushed back into Russia. But although experiencing a significant number of casualties, they were able to withdraw more or less intact, and they remained a viable combat unit. The sequence of linked battles in East Prussia had ultimately been a horrific tragedy for Russia. In 2.5 weeks of fighting, the Russians had suffered 250,000 casualties, and they had lost incredible amounts of equipment. One army commander had committed suicide. Three corps commanders had been taken prisoner. This certainly sounds disastrous, but Russia's greatest military asset was its vast manpower reserves, and even losses on this scale were soon replaced and really did not seriously weaken the overall strength of the Russian army. The real significance of the Battle of Tannenberg lies in the influence that the Eastern Front had on the war in the West. The Germans had launched their invasion of France with great initial success. They were actually keeping to the ambitious timetable that called for the capture of Paris within 6 weeks. In fact, things were going so well that when the news of the Russian invasion of East Prussia and the Russians' early minor victory at Gumbinnen arrived at the German high command, they felt that victory in France was so assured that it would be safe to remove two army corps from the offensive in France and send them to reinforce the Eighth Army in East Prussia. Now, by the time those forces had actually been transported across the width of Germany, the Battle of Tannenberg was already won, so they ended up not being needed at all in the east. Meanwhile, however, the offensive in France had bogged down, and it was ultimately stopped just a few miles short of Paris at the Battle of the Marne. Ever since, historians have speculated that the Germans might have succeeded in taking Paris had the attack in France not been fatally weakened at that key moment by sending away those two army corps to East Prussia. There's no way of knowing for sure whether the two corps would have made a difference if they had stayed in France, but it's certainly one of the more intriguing what-if scenarios in all of military history. If they had captured Paris, the Germans might well have won World War I, and the entire subsequent course of the 20th century would have been radically different. In any event, Tannenberg was a brilliant victory for the Germans, and amply rewarded the daring of Hoffmann, Hindenburg, and Ludendorff. But it was equally made possible by the many errors committed by the Russians.
Lecture 20. Gallipoli. Churchill dooms Allied assault.
After the initial drama of the battles of Tannenberg in the east and the Marne in the west, World War I bogged down into the bloody impasse of trench warfare. As a result, Britain's military leaders began to look around for a way to break the stalemate. The tragic result of this desire would be one of the most infamous episodes of military incompetence in history, the Gallipoli campaign. Among Germany's allies was the Ottoman Empire, which had its capital at Constantinople. The Turks controlled the Dardanelles. That's the slender waterway that separates Europe from Asia. The land that bounded the western side of these straits was the Gallipoli Peninsula. Ottoman domination of the Dardanelles greatly hindered coordination and the transportation of supplies between Britain and its ally, Russia. Britain's greatest area of advantage over Germany was its powerful navy. So, Winston Churchill, who at the time was the first lord of the Admiralty, came up with a plan that would employ the navy to force a passage through the Dardanelles. It was believed that British warships could then threaten Constantinople, knock the Ottoman Empire out of the war, and facilitate communication with Russia. The Ottomans had fortified the shores lining the Dardanelles with hundreds of cannons, and they had also strewn mines across the narrow waterway. To force their way through, the British battleships would use their big guns to pound the Turkish cannons into submission, while at the same time, minesweepers would clear away the mines. For this scheme, Churchill planned to use outdated battleships that were really no longer fit to confront Germany's modern warships. A squadron of 16 old battleships, 12 of them British, 4 of them French, was assigned to the mission. At the very last minute, though, these were supplemented by the addition of the very newest, most powerful warship in the entire Royal Navy, the dreadnought Queen Elizabeth, along with a modern battle cruiser, the Inflexible. The naval assault began on February 19th, 1915. 10 of the battleships cruised into the entrance of the straits and engaged the Turkish guns on the shore. But after 8 hours of steady bombardment and the firing off of hundreds of heavy shells, not a single Turkish cannon had been destroyed. While subsequent attacks achieved a little bit more success, the British had been wildly overconfident in their estimation of the ability of the ship's guns to disable the Turkish cannons. Lacking properly detailed maps, the ships had to try to aim their fire by direct observation. And the idea was that they would use 3 spotter aircraft, which in theory would hover over the Turkish emplacements, note the fall of shot, and then relay corrections back to the ship's gunners. To work, such feedback has to take place immediately to be of any value. So, given that the aircraft lacked radios and had to report their observations by the cumbersome method of flying all the way back to the ship and then attempting to drop a message down to the gunners, it's difficult to see how anybody really thought that this would constitute an effective method of fire control. In any event, the scheme failed miserably when one plane had its propeller fall apart shortly after takeoff, a second was unable to gain enough altitude, and its pilot was shot, and over the course of the engagement, the third managed to report only a single long out-of-date gunnery adjustment. During the next month, the Allied squadron made repeated, although now rather half-hearted, attacks on the Turkish positions, with minimal results. If the battleship's attempts to destroy the Turkish cannons were embarrassingly ineffectual, the British minesweeping efforts were downright farcical. The Navy had been unwilling to commit any of its frontline minesweepers to this expedition. And so, in their place, they had dispatched a motley assortment of 21 trawlers and fishing vessels reluctantly manned by their civilian crews, Not only were these crews very unenthusiastic about suddenly being thrust into the forefront of danger, but they were completely untrained in minesweeping techniques, and their vessels had been awkwardly converted to try to carry the necessary equipment. Even worse, most of these trawlers had a top speed of around 6 knots, and there was a strong 4-knot current that ran through the Dardanelles. This meant that the ships could barely crawl forward into the straits, which made them easy targets for the Turkish gunners on the shore. And when contrary winds or tides were added on, often they were just pushed backwards, and they could not even get to the minefields. Eventually, the civilian crews were replaced by volunteers from the Navy, but the ships they were using were simply not up to the task. Out of 17 minesweeping missions that were undertaken, only twice were the ships even able to reach the minefields. And on those occasions, the hapless minesweepers could only manage to remove 2 mines out of the nearly 400 that comprised the minefield. Confronted with all of these abject failures of the Navy, and under increasing pressure from Churchill and the cabinet to produce results, the commander of that naval squadron experienced a breakdown, and he had to be replaced. The new admiral, probably unwisely, committed himself to attempting an all-out attack, which was scheduled for March 18th. On that day, all of the battleships, organized into 3 successive waves, boldly advanced into the Dardanelles and blasted away at the defenses at short range on the shore. This must have produced an impressive amount of sound and fury. But again, the results were negligible. In return for destroying a single large Turkish cannon and temporarily disabling 4 others, the naval squadron paid a high price. No fewer than 3 of the huge battleships struck mines and were sunk. 3 more were severely damaged, some of them having to be beached just to prevent them from sinking as well. And many other ships suffered lighter damage. Overall, 1/3 of the entire squadron had either been sunk or disabled. Meanwhile, there were still hundreds of Turkish cannon lining the straits. And even if all of those had somehow been destroyed, the impenetrable minefields were virtually untouched. Now, the British would later claim that the Turks were on the verge of running out of ammunition, and if the attack had either been pressed home or maybe repeated the next day, it would have succeeded. But recent evidence analysis indicates that that was just wishful thinking. Rather than cutting their losses and giving up on what was probably a bad idea to start with, the British now chose to commit army troops to an amphibious invasion aimed at seizing control of the straits. The Secretary of State for War declared, if the fleet could not get through unaided, the army ought to see the business through. There could be no going back. This decision entirely undermined the original concept of the plan, which was to use naval power to assist the ground war in Europe without drawing any troops away from that crucial front. Now, 500,000 invaluable soldiers would ultimately be dispatched to what was really an unnecessary sideshow to the main war effort. Gallipoli, which formed the western shore of the Dardanelles, was composed of a tapering peninsula about 45 miles long and nowhere more than 10 miles wide. This would be the target of the Allied landings. The man put in charge of the amphibious attack on Gallipoli was General Ian Hamilton. Although he was an intelligent and experienced officer who had served in the Boer War, he was also far too much the polite Victorian gentleman, and not enough of a tough, hard-driving leader. He had an unfortunate habit of issuing tentatively worded, vague suggestions to his subordinates, rather than giving them definite and explicit orders. He really just lacked the ruthlessness to quickly dismiss incompetent commanders, but instead would let them linger on, committing mistake after mistake. His leadership style was passive and hands-off, when what would be needed in the coming campaign was a vigorous, assertive commander-in-chief. Compounding these faults, Hamilton had to work with poor intelligence, both on Turkish military capabilities and the terrain of the Gallipoli Peninsula. When his staff sought the latest intelligence reports, instead they were just given an old textbook on the Turkish army and a handful of tourist guidebooks. While they were able to obtain a decent map, it dated from 1908, and its scale was too large to provide the necessary topographic information that would allow their guns to accurately fire on hidden targets. If the Allies had begun the campaign with the Gallipoli invasion, it might have succeeded. And that's because originally the peninsula was only very lightly defended by just two Turkish divisions. When the ultimately ineffectual naval attacks began, however, this was doubled to four divisions, making it a far tougher prospect to conquer. Thus, any element of surprise was irretrievably lost. Then, the Allied assault suffered a most inopportune delay when it was discovered that the supplies in their cargo ships had been packed in the wrong order, so that vital items that would be needed by the troops immediately after hitting the beach were at the very bottom of the holds. The cargo handling facilities on the Greek island where the amphibious assault force had been assembled were inadequate to rearrange the supplies. And so all the ships had to be sent off to Alexandria in Egypt to be repacked. This incident set back the operation a full month. And during this time, the Turks were able to construct fortifications and, more importantly, to augment the four divisions of troops already in the Gallipoli Peninsula with an additional two divisions. Thus, while Gallipoli had originally been held by only two divisions, after all of these failed attacks and delays, there would now be six divisions of defenders pitted against five attacking Allied divisions. Hamilton devised an unnecessarily complicated plan that involved seven different landing sites plus diversionary attacks in which troops would briefly set foot ashore and then re-embark onto the ships. Typical of Hamilton, the orders given to unit commanders were often vague, rarely specifying clear ultimate objectives. The result was that it left a number of the assault groups uncertain as to how far they should advance, or even whether they were intended to constitute one of the main important attacks, or if they were merely to play a supporting role. In some cases, the beach on which they were to disembark was not clearly indicated, and various debates have raged ever since over whether or not some contingents came ashore at completely the wrong locations. A theme that ran throughout the Allied planning for the attack was a widespread and rather arrogant assumption that the defending Turkish troops were cowardly and that they would either be easily overcome or would simply run away when the Allied troops advanced upon them. As it turned out, the Turks would prove extremely tenacious and brave. Really, Churchill's entire scheme had been founded on such flawed presuppositions, since nobody seems to have given much thought as to what the naval force would actually do if and when it somehow managed to push through the Dardanelles towards Constantinople. Everyone seems to have believed that the Turks would meekly surrender at the mere sight of a British squadron offshore, despite the fact that there were quite formidable defenses protecting the city. The landings began on April 25th. 28,000 British troops of the 29th and Royal Naval Divisions were assigned to land on five sites around the tip of the Gallipoli Peninsula. These were designated beaches S, V, W, and X, and Y. About 10 miles further up the peninsula, the 31,000 men of the 1st Australian and New Zealand Divisions, who were known by the acronym ANZACS, were to go ashore at what was labeled Z Beach. And finally, 17,000 French troops were to land on the Asian side of the straits at a site called Kumkale. While all this was going on, Hamilton cruised back and forth offshore aboard the Queen Elizabeth, and this was a distant position that kept him far removed from the quickly changing events on the beaches, and it basically precluded him from exercising any close control over the battlefield so that he might solve problems or take advantage of opportunities. The landings met with mixed success. To the north, at Z Beach, the ANZACS disembarked about a mile north of the intended spot. This was possibly because of some unexpectedly strong currents which pushed their boats upward. They initially met only weak defenses, and they might have grabbed strategically important high ground. But Mustafa Kemal, the local Turkish commander, intelligently reacted faster, and he rushed his own men onto the heights. The ANZACS then became pinned down in a narrow zone close to the beach. When they asked to be withdrawn from this very unpromising situation, they were instead told to stick it out and dig, dig, dig. Further south, at Y Beach, the British troops had landed completely unopposed, and they scrambled up a high cliff. They then had a terrific chance to seize a considerable amount of very important high ground that was further inland before the Turks could react. Incredibly, however, the commander was content to have his men just sit at the top of the cliff doing absolutely nothing for the entire day. One unit actually walked up to the top of the hill that would have given them command over the entire region, but after looking around a bit, they then abandoned that vital strategic position and just returned to the cliff edge. Even in his distant post aboard the Queen Elizabeth, Hamilton recognized the opportunity being presented, and twice he sent messages to the local commander suggesting that he commit more troops to the zone. Fatally, however, Hamilton phrased these in his usual tentative manner, asking, "Would you like to get some more troops ashore at Y Beach? If so, trawlers available." A less polite but more dynamic commander would unequivocally ordered his subordinate to immediately exploit the lack of Turkish resistance. Instead, Hamilton's meek message was simply ignored, and the chance was irretrievably lost. At V, W, and X beaches, which encircled the very tip of the peninsula, British troops encountered more opposition. Those sites were overseen by Turkish prepared trenches, and there were barbed wire obstacles. At W Beach, Turkish machine guns sliced through the boats, crammed with soldiers.